It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Milwaukee has some of the most expensive health insurance costs compared with cities around the country. We'll try to figure out why that is.
First, we're looking at some news just out about the University of Wisconsin system.
Yesterday, Governor Walker acknowledged that he is considering giving more autonomy to the UW system, but he said details won't come out until his budget address on February 3rd.
Reporter Dan Simmons has been covering the story for the Wisconsin State Journal since it broke over the weekend. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Well, Governor Walker considering granting more autonomy to the UW system. What would autonomy look like for the UW system in this case?
It's unclear the specifics. Some people have suggested that the system would decouple from the state and be operated under what's called a public authority model, similar to how UW hospitals are operated. It would get a lot more autonomy in how it hires and fires people, and how it builds does capital infrastructure and other measures. So that would be sort of the more severe route. Otherwise, the system would stay under stay as part of the state and be governed as it is now, but gain some exemptions from state laws in things like how they buy things and how they build things.
Now, you mentioned the term public authority system, which is one option that's on the table as to how this could unfold. What is a public authority system, and how does it function?
It's a public-private hybrid. The entity, in this case UW system, would be run by a similar kind of a board of directors, similar to how a corporation is run, who would have authority over things like, it's been rumored that it would have authority over setting tuition, which is currently done by the regents at the direction of the legislature.
Now, having more autonomy is something the UW system has lobbied for a long time. What do they see as the possible benefits from this?
Being freed from what they see as somewhat restrictive state policies when it comes to things like, as I've mentioned, not hiring people and setting salaries and setting tuition and buildings. The universities have for a long time argued that academic enterprises are a different animal than most state agencies, and that they need, in some areas, to be able to operate in a way that's consistent with other universities across the country who they're competing against.
Well, one possible trade-off for this autonomy could be reduced state funding. Do we know what kind of reduction we're talking about?
We don't. Those details will come out in the budget if indeed this survives and Governor Walker includes it in his budget. It still remains to be seen.
Well, not everyone is on board with this. One concern that I've seen is how to control student costs. What is the worry there?
The worry is that the legislature would no longer have any say in tuition costs, and there would be no regulating how much universities could increase tuition year to year, and thus they could students would have less of a safeguard against very large year to year tuition hikes.
And one option that keeps coming up, at least it's been a big thing in the past, was the idea of splitting UW-Madison from the rest of the UW system. And this is something that Governor Walker was an advocate of, and this was proposed in 2011. The measure died after a huge outcry from UW system figures. Is that still on the table somehow with this new proposal?
That appears not to be. It appears to be different this time around, just from the rumblings we're hearing, in that this would be a system-wide break from the state, and that UW-Madison themselves, they've said they don't support a similar split as was proposed in 2011. And UW system president Ray Cross said yesterday that he is quite opposed to that as well.
So that's something that's still on people's minds, you know, even 3-4 years later.
Yeah, that's the model everyone is used to, and is sort of fitting this proposal into, but it's actually a different model this time around.
This time around, given this potential decoupling of the university system from some oversight from the legislature, from the state, what kind of support does it have in the legislature?
Not much, from what I can glean. You know, it was the proposal in 2011 to split UW-Madison pretty much went down in flames, as you mentioned. And it's obviously this is in the broad outlines, it's different than that proposal. It's hard to see how in the intervening 4 years much has changed about how the legislature will view this, but we'll see.
Now, Ray Cross has asked the Walker administration for $95 million in the next 2-year budget. How likely is that figure when we look at what the UW system might get?
Early indication, it appears quite unlikely that that any agency will get that big of a boost in funding. The state is trying to dig out of a $2.2 billion budget hole, and Governor Walker has indicated that no one's going to be getting much of an increase. The co-chairman of the Joint Finance Committee earlier called that UW request a tough sell.
And as far as this proposal, again, of splitting, decoupling the university system from the state, what sort of response has it gotten at the university system?
Not much. No one's talking about it too much because, again, just out of respect to the governor's process in forming a budget. The university's clearly and for a long time have wanted additional autonomy and flexibilities. The extent to which they get that and the details of that will determine their level of support.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too. That was Dan Simmons, reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He was with us to talk about news that Governor Walker is considering giving more autonomy to the University of Wisconsin system.
Over the past 6 years, the United States has set out to revamp how healthcare works. The effort has been to lower costs and increase coverage. As of this year, after those changes, Milwaukee has some of the most expensive health insurance in the country. That's according to statistics compiled by the company GoHealth.
It ranks fifth among most expensive large cities in each state at an average of $333 a month for a silver plan, which is the suggested level of coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Compare that with our neighbors in Minnesota. The average in Minneapolis is the third cheapest at $183 a month, and the least expensive is Albuquerque, New Mexico at $171 a month.
Here to talk about why Milwaukee's health insurance is expensive is Michael Mahoney. He's a healthcare expert and senior vice president of consumer marketing for GoHealth, a website that matches people with health insurance plans. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what data did you look at? How did we figure out that Milwaukee ranks among the most expensive cities when it comes to healthcare plans?
Sure. It's based on publicly available data, some of it from Health and Human Services and the rest from the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's based on the 2015 premiums using a 40-year-old non-smoker making about $30,000 a year. And we looked at the subsidized premium and the unsubsidized premium.
So what cities did you include in this research?
Similar cities, Detroit, Boston, Portland, Baltimore, you know, major cities around the U.S. There were 51 cities involved in the study. What we were trying to do is answer the question that we get most often, which is, what does health insurance look like for me next year? And for us, we operate in all 50 states, so we wanted to make sure we had a global view of what that looks like for most consumers as they headed into open enrollment.
And we mentioned the Silver Plan. I think that's defined by the Affordable Care Act. What kind of coverage does that give us?
Well, there are several different levels of coverage, from bronze up to platinum. Silver was really what the ACA was designed around. It was a relatively good amount of coverage. So it's really what the those that wrote the law were designing consumers to sign up for. So it's really what consumers should look for when purchasing a plan.
So I guess the mystery here is why Milwaukee is expensive compared to cities around the country. What kind of cities usually ended up at the more expensive end of the spectrum?
Sure. Well, last year, for example, one of the most expensive areas to insure was a rural area, Summit County, Colorado. And that makes sense because there's fewer choice when it comes to health care systems. So the amount that a health insurance company can negotiate with a health care provider is usually constrained. The more health insurance providers there are, the more competition and the lower the rates through those negotiations. Also, the more insurers that are in an area, usually the lower prices, there are lower prices because there's more competition amongst insurance companies. There's usually one that says, hey, I'm going to drop my price to get a greater share of the market. What's interesting to note is that Milwaukee is neither rural, nor is there a little bit of competition. I mean, there's a lot. There's 15 insurers that represent over 150 plans in the area. So there's a lot of choice. So it is very curious that it is one of the highest and most expensive premium areas in the nation.
And some other cities in your top five seem to be higher cost of living places. Is that right?
That's correct. The cost of living does have an impact on it, as well as regulatory action. The states can still determine what are acceptable and unacceptable premium increases by state. So that, too, has caused a lot of areas to have lower and or higher costs.
So Milwaukee, as you said, not rural. It has a fair amount of competition. It's not a high cost of living city. So what's the deal with the higher cost of these silver level premiums in the city?
I wish I knew. If I knew, then we could counteract it. We could get a lot of people a better deal. But the important thing to mention is that this is all unsubsidized premium, and then that's really the punchline. So although Milwaukee, as you said, does differ from the other four most expensive cities, I mean, they're all rural. Anchorage, Alaska, Burlington, Vermont, not as rural, Cheyenne, Wyoming, and then New York City is a prime example of higher cost of living. The one thing to keep in mind is once you factor in premiums or premium subsidies, for the example we're talking about, 40-year-old non-smoker, there are 47 cities. 47 out of these 51 all have the same premium. So the real punchline is make sure that if you're eligible for a subsidy, that you get it, because it can very much bring down your cost.
So the subsidy for the person in, say, Milwaukee getting this more expensive health insurance, that subsidy could well fill the gap as they would pay, for what they would pay in another city versus Milwaukee.
Oh, that's correct. It would take that $333 premium on average down to $208, which would put it on par with many other cities, 47 out of the 51 that we looked at.
So I suppose from the perspective of somebody managing health coverage under the Affordable Care Act, they'd like to see the cost go down in Milwaukee to lower the subsidy they'd have to pay to fill that gap.
One would assume so. I mean, the subsidies are to try to make health insurance more affordable for people that are either signing up for the first time or coming off a different type of insurance, be it group, COBRA, or individual that is expiring.
So what kind of things might help drive those premiums down? You said there's a fair amount of competition already. Is it likely that either one of the already existing competitors might go wildcat and start dropping their rates, or that there might be a new player seeing an opportunity here?
Well, both of those have happened actually this year, especially with new players. The co-ops that were formed specifically for the ACA, they needed to achieve a certain member base in order to be solvent, to have a stable group to spread the risk across. And then existing players were looking at it, especially ones that came back into the market this year, and trying to figure out how they gained market share. And you're right, dropping price is one of the main ways to do that. But you got to be careful. If you drop price too much, then you won't have enough revenue to cover the costs of those new lives that you're insuring. I do think next year and the year after we'll see less price volatility, simply because the insurers that are competing in each one of the marketplaces will have seen what it actually costs to provide coverage to the people that they've signed up, and there'll be more reticence to have wild swings in premiums.
Now, you're looking at the biggest cities in each state. Does what's happening in Milwaukee give us any indication of what might be happening in the rest of Wisconsin, or have you seen that happening around the country?
In general, the trends that we see across the country do apply to Wisconsin, the rural versus city, lots of choice versus little when it comes to negotiating costs with healthcare providers. But again, that's why the study's so interesting, because Milwaukee very much sticks out. It's not rural. There's a ton of choice. So one would think they would have one of the lowest costs. You know, the only way to truly know for sure is to have a backroom ear into what happened with insurance companies and hospital systems and their negotiations, and also look at the true cost of care. You know, what does it truly cost an insurance company to provide care for somebody in Milwaukee? Without knowing that, we don't know actually what drove these decisions.
I'd like to compare and contrast. How does Milwaukee stack up with what's going on in neighboring big cities, places like Chicago or Minneapolis-St. Paul? How do they stack up when it comes to cost, and what's different about them that explains the differences?
Sure. Well, Chicago, prior to subsidy, it's the opposite end of the spectrum. If Milwaukee's number five and most expensive, Chicago's 41 and Minneapolis is number 47. After subsidies are applied, though, Chicago is exactly on par with Milwaukee, and that's why it's so that's why it's so important for people that are eligible for a subsidy to make sure they get the maximum subsidy, not only their advanced premium tax credit, but if they choose a silver plan, cost-sharing reductions, because that truly does take insurance for a lot of people from unaffordable to affordable.
Now, is state policy an issue here? Wisconsin rejected some of the federal funding for Medicaid expansion. Some of our neighbors, Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, and Michigan, took that money, I believe, in all those cases. Does that play into the cost of premiums at the local level?
It does, but it's hard to say which way it's affecting it. You know, on one hand, people that are either eligible and have not signed up for Medicaid, what they would call woodworkers, would also sign up and claim benefits on the system. At the same time, there's a strong case to be made that by not expanding it, people in the system are able to have a much lower cost from the insurers that are providing it. So, again, without knowing the exact specifics of how it impacts each at a local level, it's really hard to say. But again, these are the premiums that are unsubsidized. So the real impact study is going to be after February 15th. Once open enrollment has closed, how many people in Milwaukee actually signed up and how many actually got a subsidy? Because if the people signing up are all obtaining subsidies, or it's like last year and it's over 78% are obtaining subsidies, then Milwaukee is actually quite affordable.
Now, this is a snapshot, these numbers we're talking about. You also took this snapshot last year. How have things changed between then and now?
Well, last year we very much saw things like that rural rule hold true. You know, rural areas were, in every state, more expensive than urban areas. I think the big difference this year, and I'm entirely hypothesizing in terms of the impact on Milwaukee, is that both insurers and hospital systems were able to take a look at almost 1 year of care for people that had signed up under the Affordable Care Act and have a better estimate of what that would cost them moving forward. So I think this year it's very much a reaction to last year's cost structure, which makes me think that next year and the year after we'll very much see a flatlining in terms of premium changes within a state for the average user.
Well, that's really interesting. So we were, in effect, in uncharted territory last year. For better or worse, we're going to see things shake out and get an idea of what things really do and maybe should cost as these things settle down?
One would definitely hope so, yes.
So what are you watching for? You mentioned the enrollment numbers coming up in February. What should we be watching out for to see how these premium costs go over the next year? And if we talk to you, at the next year's snapshot.
Well, it's really up to each carrier. It depends on what the insurance company or insurance carrier is trying to achieve in that market that year. This year, we saw some insurance carriers that said, in this market, I have to have a larger share of the population, so I'm going to drop my rates to gain market share. Other insurance companies looked at it and said, man, that area just, I can't provide the level of service and or it's not as profitable as I want, so I'm going to keep my rates where they are, knowing I might lose market share. You know, other ones said, I have a big name out there, everybody's going to choose me, so I'm not going to make a change. So the real impact is, for me, at the end of open enrollment, I'll be looking at a lot of the new entrants and seeing how many people they signed up, and then using that to project what will their rates be next year based on the gap between their membership goals and what they actually signed up during the second year of open enrollment.
Now, pre-Affordable Care Act, healthcare costs and insurance premiums kept going up substantially year after year. That's part of the problem, I guess, that the act was trying to solve. Have we seen changes? Has that been tapering off, that increase in cost?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that because I think people have a misunderstanding when they're talking about cost. A lot of consumers are thinking just about premium, and that's really not the cost of healthcare. It's your premium plus your expenditures on your actual care. So you might look at a person now that says, hey, you know, I save money and this is great, but my deductible went from $2,500 to $7,500 or $10,000 or $12,500. So what it really takes is a few years of people actually using their care and then comparing their out-of-pocket costs with their prior out-of-pocket costs. And that's a question a lot of people are having is, what is the usage for all the new entrants, either people that didn't have coverage or people that were shifting from a group or COBRA or their own pre-ACA plan? And how are they using coverage today, and how does that impact their out-of-pocket costs?
A lot to untangle. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Michael Mahoney. He's a healthcare expert and senior vice president of consumer marketing for GoHealth, looking at the costs of healthcare in Milwaukee and beyond.
Last week, the Capital Times newspaper in Madison announced it will no longer allow comments on their website directly under the news stories. Readers are encouraged to take their comments to Facebook, send an email to the author, or email the paper's opinion editors instead.
And we're taking your calls during this conversation. Do you think it's a good idea to get rid of comments on online news stories? Do you participate in online conversations that you can see under the story? Do you enjoy them, or do they bug you? What are those exchanges like? How could they be better? Or are we better off without them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Paul Fanlon is back with us to talk about why the Capital Times decided to end comments on their website. He's the editor there. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, why did the Capital Times decide to stop allowing comments on the website under the stories?
Well, we'd been looking at the change for the last year or two, and what we noticed, what was happening, was that we're talking specifically about the unfiltered, immediate, unedited, and usually anonymous comments, that they were authored by a smaller and smaller subset of commenters, and they had more of a troll quality than not as time went along. And we found anecdotally more and more people choosing not to go into the comment section because they were surrounded by hostility and not very welcoming environment there. And we decided that we are continuing to be very interested in engagement with our audience. So this isn't a step away from that or censorship, as some have suggested, but instead a modification so that we're directing the conversation over to Facebook, where technically we have a better ability to moderate the comments and to have a constructive conversation, not an altogether positive conversation. It's not that we're not open to criticism. We are, but one that most people find more useful.
Now, were these comments that you're talking about, were they anonymous, or were people accountable by some kind of name or handle?
They were typically some sort of name or handle, and there was some banning of individuals who kept using profanity or just stepping over the line, but as we went along, there were probably 15 or 20 individuals who tended to dominate. And one of the things I think is worth noting is that my columns often attracted quite a few comments. And what I was noticing was the first 5 or 10 comments may be about the column, and then they would veer off into unrelated name-calling between and among the commenters, and there would be 150, 200 comments, the last 140 of which had nothing to do with the column.
You liken it, I think, to an Onion headline at one point about awful comments getting in the way of people understanding the news. Is that how you see it?
Well, yes. Various magazines, particularly serious science magazines, have did a study and determined that people actually came away with a different opinion or different reaction and different trust in the story. So I believe Scientific American cut off comment some time ago. I think it's interesting. I think newspapers are approaching this differently. I think the New York Times is wonderful and does just about everything right. And they do a wonderful job with comments, but they also allocate a lot of staff time to the aggressive moderation of comments. And one of the decisions I made and we made as a management team was that we'd rather have our staff creating original journalism and not trying to stay in front of moderating comments.
Now, the people who commented, I suppose some people may have a Facebook page and be in the habit of going to a Facebook page or some other social media. Others may not, and it might be easier to just be on a website and click and comment. Are you worried at all about shutting the door on some of that conversation?
I'd be lying if I said I wasn't somewhat concerned. We do have a robust, for an organization our size, opinion staff, and we really encourage and welcome emailed letters and do an aggressive job of processing those quickly and sharing those in a letters format every day. We also, probably more than about any newspaper I can think of, emphasize op-ed pieces from members of the community, experts in the university community, and we're very interested in engagement. And as time moves along, we may find a way to go back to some sort of comments model. But I obviously had a lot of conversations about this, and one of the things, a couple of the things I say to people is that I'm edited, my columns are edited, everything else that appears under the Capital Times banner, under the Capital Times brand, is edited. The comments, in some sense, and the New York Times said this recently, they see the comments as an extension of their journalism and as part of their brand. And I do as well, and I think that we decided to make this move, and it's less a slam door than it is a different approach.
Was there warning to the community that this move was under consideration? I know sometimes people talk about self-policing happening during online communities. Someone saying to somebody else, "Hey, knock it off. Let's stay on track. Let's keep it clean." That kind of thing. Was that ever an option?
Well, we tried that. We had a couple of our staff members go in and do more moderating and try to get involved in the conversation. I was encouraged in my own columns over time to get involved with readers. I try to do a pretty conscientious job of responding to emails, critical or supportive, sent directly to me. And I think one of the things we want to do out of this is to try to share the feedback we get in our digital community, in a digital format, in story forms that are maybe aggregations of comments, and to approach things differently going forward. But no, we didn't give notice. People, there is a lot of emotion around comments. I read a New York Times piece from their ombudsperson about half of their calls are about the comments. They're not about the journalism in the New York Times. So there's high reader interest in it, and I suspect a lot of different opinions out among your listenership. But again, it comes back to us focusing on our resources on how do we produce the best experience for our audience, and this is the decision we made.
And do you see social media as being effective at taking the place of these comments? What do you see as the benefits about moving there other than the staff resources?
Well, on Facebook, for example, I was talking to two of our people who oversee this afternoon that the response has been about 10 to 1 favorable in terms of what we did here. And the Facebook identities are typically identified by name on Facebook, and there's a sort of a different culture on Facebook, so we don't get a lot of the kind of reflexive attack. For those listeners who don't know, we're a progressive news organization in our opinions, and so we get a lot of flack from the right, and an awful lot of the comments had that flavor to it sort of reflexively. It's not to say that we also don't receive a lot of input and criticism from the left, but so that would be an answer.
Well, we're going to get our listeners in on this, and let's take a call right now. We've got Deb joining us from Menasha. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I agree that we need to monitor some of the comments, whether via Facebook or social media. However, we also need to understand that sometimes when we're writing articles or sharing the news or representing a story, we do tend to have some sort of opinion influenced it with the facts that we share and what we conclude in our stories. So if we're filtering some of the comments from readers, it might be a good idea to also include a review of these underneath the article, not necessarily exactly what they said, but somebody who is putting a little review to add to the articles to show some different points or people that are changing some of the facts or the stories and coming up with different ideas.
Okay, interesting idea, Deb. Thanks for that. Deb suggesting a summary. Again, this would require staff resources and time to curate this a little bit, but to pick the best points of view and maybe put it at the bottom of the article.
Well, that is not a bad. That's a good idea, and in fact, we've done that and created stories out of curations of input and reader views and put them online. The world of digital journalism is evolving so quickly, and there are different forms, and we're surprised sometimes because we can see and measure readership in ways we couldn't, obviously, in the days of print, when there was only print. And I'm constantly surprised by how things that I didn't think would draw a large audience do, and a lot of them are around the curation of comments.
We're talking right now with Capital Times editor Paul Fanlund about the paper's decision to end comments on their website.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you read online comments under a news article? Do you post comments there? Are these a great place to exchange ideas or just hives of incivility? Do you think it's a good idea to, as this paper did, get rid of the comment section? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion about why the Capital Times newspaper in Madison decided to stop allowing comments directly under stories on their website, talking with its editor, Paul Fanlund. He's here in the studio with us.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go to the online comments and maybe in your local paper's website? What do you think? Do you ever participate in the discussions, or does the incivility tend to steer you away? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Trent joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Trent.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I always comment on news stories for the most part, especially on Facebook when I see a story posted from pretty much any news site online after I read the story. I tend to almost always leave a comment or scroll through the comments and reply to other people. I do think that there is a certain number of people that do troll online, and they just basically throw negative things out there on purpose just to cause a stir. And, you know, and I think that does ruin the journalism of it because, yeah, I know exactly what that gentleman was talking about before. You know, I have seen news stories where, you know, 50 to 60 comments down, nobody's talking about the story anymore. It's all about, you know, name calling and whatnot. I don't see that incredibly often on actual news stories. It's usually on, you know, more local news type deals. Mm-hmm. But
and Trent, so do you support this decision to end the comment section? You're a commenter, but you also see the trolls. So what do you think about the decision?
No, I mean, personally, I would like to be able to still comment under stories when I read them, just because, you know, I mean, also you have to thank other people, especially on Facebook, when they do that, they can publish it to their own pages, and then now all their friends are seeing, you know, what their opinion on a certain matter is, and it kind of makes it easier in that retrospect. But,
okay, thank you so much for your thoughts, Trent. And what would you say to that? You hear someone who does comment regularly, does recognize that there are issues, and yet he'd still like the comments.
Yeah, I think the mention of Facebook is interesting. We have really emphasized over the last year and a half, the use of social media to broaden our readership base, and has been really gratifying and successful that we've done it. And how much we've accomplished with people, the power of an individual recommending, a friend recommending a piece of content, my column, a story to someone else, and then having that be sort of exponentially distributed. It's been very gratifying. It's been really important to a 20% growth in the Capital Times audience over the last year. I think that the last caller was very reasonable in his discussion about wanting to comment, and I think we can do that on Facebook, and we'll continue to work at the Facebook experience for those who want to be in the comments and to participate there. So I see it. I see his comments as mostly consistent with what we're trying to do.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Trent. And on we go to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just think that we have to really watch on how we may be starting to create censorship, and by losing opportunities for a comment on articles, because a lot of times people are adding information to it that other people may not know, and then it builds the story. It goes beyond the story and the content. And you're going to always have to filter through the uneducated, what else to call them, hairball kind of people, because that's out there in the world. So you're going to get the mix, and you have to filter through that so that you can keep a line of decorum going and an educated conversation going. And I think that's what's really important. We can't succumb to the ridiculousness of some people in block our own communication with each other.
Thank you so much, Gail. Appreciate your thoughts there. And she says we need to be careful that we don't lose opportunities and promote some kind of censorship. What do you say to that, Paul?
I agree with her. I think that hardly a week goes by when a whistleblower or someone perceives himself to be a whistleblower doesn't contact me or a member of the Capital Times staff, and we're fine on protecting their identities. We're also fine on sharing the views of people where there's a logical reason, retribution from an employer or some other rationale for anonymity. I'm not a big adherent to the fact that to the view that anonymity is part of free speech and that it's terribly useful to retain that anonymity to be able to kind of pop off and talk about anything, and so the reader at the end is left to guess whether the viewpoint is valid, the information suggested is credible, and without with anonymity, there is less credibility.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Gail. And let's go next to Marina. She joins us from La Crosse. Hi, Marina.
Hi. I think that your guest is, I think he's right on track, and I think that this is a really great idea. As someone who writes letters to the editor and writes into my local newspaper a lot, it's very intimidating to see the comments on the website. I don't even like to look at them. It's really disheartening and very intimidating and makes me want to not share my opinion. And I think without that intimidation factor, it would be a lot easier for people to share their opinion.
Okay, appreciate that call, Marina. And Marina likes what you've done there and says that it was intimidating before seeing those comments. Did you hear that from other people?
We have. In fact, we did not allow comments on letters to the editor because we thought it would suppress participation in letters to the editor. And in some of the articles I read leading up to this decision and in some conversations around the newsroom, there was even a sense that some people don't want to participate. Some sources are more reluctant to participate in news stories on the record because of the potential for the shredding they would receive anonymously in comments.
Do you think that the very fact that there were some of these difficult comments there, did it keep people away from the paper in general, do you think? Or reading an article all the way to the bottom, even?
That's an interesting question. I guess I don't have a strong answer. I've been at this business of journalism for decades, my whole career, and I really feel strongly that everything we do, whether it's a news story or an opinion or the letters we choose or just everything, connects back to the brand, to what the Capital Times represents to people. Just as I'm a great admirer of Wisconsin Public Radio and all the connections of brand back to it, and I just felt that finally, this particular sewer, which is what we called it internally, became so detrimental to our perception of what we were trying to do as a brand that we had to act.
So you're saying that actually interfered with the Capital Times brand? You thought that the comments were so maybe damaging?
Yes, that's true. I think they are at some point when we're trying to apply all sorts of professional standards throughout everything else we do, and then there's this one island of it's an outlier.
And Paul, as we wrap up, do you expect other news outlets to follow suit like this?
Well, many have. I actually, in the last couple of weeks, did a lot of additional research, even though I've been reading about this right along. A lot of them have stopped comments in the way we have. Some of them have a closer integration with Facebook as a method going forward. I think that it will continue. I think an important part of this is the headwinds faced by media everywhere in the last decade in terms of having staff resources. So it comes back to, in a perfect world, I would love to have three people I could assign to running the most robust comment section in the state. But that's not reality.
And we have to leave it there. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Paul Fanlon joins us. He's the editor of the Capital Times. He joined us to talk about the paper's decision to get rid of the online comments section.
Getting back to social media for a moment, there's been ongoing concern about possible negative effects from time spent on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media sites. One open question, do they add to our levels of stress?
Well, a new study from the Pew Research Group finds that there's no association between time spent on Facebook and Twitter and increased levels of stress, with one exception, if one of our online friends is going through a stressful event, then apparently that stresses us out, and that kind of stress apparently can be contagious.
This rings kind of true for me. I don't come away from looking at, Facebook or whatever, feeling stressed out. I will come away feeling like I just spent a lot of time doing absolutely nothing. So I guess that's a bit of stress, feeling I wasted all that time.
Right. As far as me, well, my daughter, she deleted the app on my phone for Facebook. I don't know how she did it. She knows how she did it.
But she's not telling.
I thought, you know what? This is okay for a while, not having Facebook. So I'm on a Facebook sabbatical for right now.
By accident.
By accident. But it's okay.
The accidental New Year's resolution.
It's good to mix it up sometimes.
Well, and I like this. We're empathetic. Our friends are feeling stressed. So we feel a little stressed for them. I'm okay with that.
Right. There's some good news about social media.
Good news study.